In our third case this morning, 2023-1076, Janet Hild, administrator of the estate of Scott Boldman versus Samaritan Health Partner. On behalf of the appellants, Mr. Welsh and Mr. Haviland. Mr. Welsh, it's my understanding that you are going to begin. You're going to argue for 8 minutes, then Mr. Haviland for 5 minutes, then rebuttal for 2 minutes. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
You are responsible for watching the clock to ensure that your colleague gets his sufficient allotted time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. I am John Welch. I represent the anesthesia providers in this particular case. We are asking the court not only to reverse the Second District's appellate opinion, but to make a rule that in negligence cases, medical malpractice cases included, that the same juror rule should apply to the evaluation or determinations of negligence and proximate cause, and follow the pattern jury instructions that are in OJI or the Ohio jury instructions.
Do you think that there have to be separate interrogatories on negligence and proximate cause? I mean, there usually are, but do you think, and so assuming that that would, your answer would be yes, does that have any effect on the same juror rule?
There are separate interrogatories, and they are separate inquiries, but they are interdependent. Just as a determination of liability is a precondition for comparative negligence or apportionment of liability, as this court in O'Connell ruled, negligence is a precondition to proximate cause. So they are interdependent. You can't have proximate cause of injury without finding negligence. I mean, that. So in the elements of the case are, there's duty, but there's breach of duty, there's negligence, and negligence must proximately cause injury before a jury gets to damages.
So if the jury would find that something didn't rise to the level of negligence, it could still say, yeah, but that accident still caused their death, couldn't they?
They could, but that's not the standard, Justice. So in other words,
I understand, but it's just in terms of that, this like esoteric question about how interrelated or integrated they are.
Right, but one depends on the other. So in other words, the proximate cause interrogatory that is not an issue in the case, but is very routine and standard, speaks to the elements of a malpractice case. And the answer is, the first interrogatory is negligence. The second is, do you find that the negligence, if they find negligence, do you find that the negligence of the defendant was a proximate cause of injury? The interrogatory doesn't say, do you find that the defendant's conduct caused injury? Or do you find that the defendant's set of actions, which was alluded to by the Second District, caused injury?
And you're speaking of like the Ohio jury instruction, OJI, correct?
Right. So the OJI standard pattern instructions do have the negligence interrogatory, and then they say only those jurors who find negligence can deliberate on proximate cause.
So I understand the logic of the same juror rule in the sense that you want, Ohio law requires a general verdict, and you want a majority or three-quarters majority of the jury to believe that someone, before someone is found liable, to find all the elements of the claim. That makes sense to me. But it doesn't necessarily seem to follow from that all jurors should be precluded from, or voters who don't find, or jurors, for example, who don't find a breach of the duty of the care, necessarily need to be precluded from deliberating about proximate cause. I mean, they certainly could offer something to the discussion. They could. It's certainly able to separate the two. As Justice Bruner pointed out, you could have a car accident, and you could say, well, it wasn't there was no negligence in the operation of the car, but you still have a causation problem. So why can't those jurors participate even under this? And I know in other states they seem to be able to.
Right. The problem with the any majority rule in that circumstance is you could have, for instance.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand, yeah. Why are the jurors not unable to participate in the discussion?
Participate as opposed to signing the interrogatory and finding proximate cause?
Right.
So if they don't find negligence, I suppose they could participate. The problem with the any majority rule, it just invites inconsistency in less than three-fourths, as Justice DeWine, you mentioned.
Counsel, isn't it the problem?
Can he ask my question?
I thought
first?
He did. Okay, nope. Go ahead.
So could they participate? I suppose they could participate, but they can't sign the interrogatory. So there's some inconsistency there. Well, you could participate, but if you come to some sort of conclusion, you can't tell anyone what your conclusion is, because then that would invite inconsistency and potentially a verdict with less than three-fourths of the majority finding the elements of the claim, meaning negligence is a proximate cause of injury.
But okay, is there any reason you couldn't do it that way? I mean, I think other states do.
Well, other states, when they do the any majority rule, is.
Well, I'm not 100% sure about this, but it's what it seems to indicate that other states who follow the same juror rule, or at least some other states, allow the jurors to participate in the discussion.
Okay. I am unaware of that specific issue, Justice DeWine, and I suppose they could participate. But if they come to a conclusion and they can't determine that conclusion or let anyone know what their conclusion is, I think that invites inconsistency.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. Counsel, I'm reading the OJI instruction. If the answer of 6 3/4 or more of the jurors to whether the defendant was negligent is yes, move to interrogatory B regarding proximate cause, and only those jurors answering yes may participate. Doesn't say general participation. They can say whatever they want. Hey, I think you should go back to negligence and rethink it because I didn't agree with you. But may participate in answering interrogatory B because proximate cause anticipates that a majority of a civil jury has found and concluded affirmatively on negligence. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right.
And that is why a full jury decides liability. So the essential issues in the case are, as this court in O'Connell said, causal negligence. It's liability. So one issue is liability, and then damages. Liability is causal negligence, one, negligence and proximate cause resulting from that negligence.
Counsel, I didn't vote to bring this case in, and let me tell you why. The
yes.
same six that voted negligence voted no proximate cause.
Yes, they did.
So what kind of case do we have here? Is there a real dispute? I mean, I'm very familiar with OJI. But is there actually a dispute in this case?
Our position is no, Your Honor. The Second District found that there was, not only was this instruction error, it was prejudicial error as a matter of law. And part of our argument is that is incorrect. There is harmless error here. There is no prejudice. The appellees got a full trial on all issues. Six jurors found the CRNA negligent. The same six found no proximate cause. So there is no prejudice. It was a proper verdict. But the Second District obviously disagreed. And we are here arguing harmless error as well, Justice.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
You're Mr. Haviland's time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to touch briefly on an issue that was also brought up in the case, and that was the issue of waiver or forfeiture of the objection itself. There is no question that The interrogatories and the jury instructions were before the parties prior to, long prior to, the instructions that were read to the jury. We had a lengthy charge conference, and I know the Court of Appeals, and maybe it's the, you know, some of the limitations of not having a court reporter in the office or in the courtroom and doing this by tape, but there was a lengthy charge conference. At no time during that conference did anybody object to the interrogatories. In fact, they're right out of OJI. I mean, they're well known. And we believe that that objection was never preserved for appeal. So,
but the objection was made over here.
I'm sorry.
The objection was made while the judge was instructing the jury by asking for a sidebar, putting it on the record, and the judge overruled it, correct?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
And the yes part is that counsel stood up and approached the bench and said words to the effect of, or I could tell you exactly, I'm pretty sure this is wrong. But there was no alternative language that was given to the court for the interrogatory. There was no suggestion about what should we do differently, no suggestion of sending the jury back while we hashed this thing out. There was nothing. We proceeded on. We don't believe that that was a clear and unequivocal objection. It's, you know, akin to saying, I disagree.
How much more did he have to say, I'm pretty sure this is wrong, I'm objecting so that I preserve?
Well, had we said that would have been great, but the words objection, I object, I'm objecting, please preserve the record, none of that was spoken.
Right, but I'm pretty sure this is wrong, and then there was some discussion about it. It wasn't just a flippant, and then, I mean, because the trial court said, well, we're going to go ahead with this.
So, well, but my understanding at the end of the sidebar, when the attorney said the belief that the doctrine is incorrect, then at the end said, I don't know that it's a big deal.
That was, that discussion occurred after the jury had gone back to begin deliberating. And we were left, the lawyers and the judge in the courtroom, and we were sitting around and we were having a lot less formal discussion than we're having right now. And there was a colloquy that went back and forth at that time, and that was kind of a half-hearted effort as well, using phrases like, I found it to be a little weird, and I'm not sure it's that big of a deal. I'd suggest that using the word objection, Your Honor, is a term of art, and that's what we're trained to do.
Didn't the judge at some point say that your objection is noted or something?
He did not.
There's no language like that.
He did not. So we don't believe that there was a clear and unequivocal objection. We believe that the issue, whether you use the phrase forfeiture or waiver, we believe it was waived. Finally, Your Honor, I to the extent that you disagree with our position in this case and affirm the Court of Appeals, we would request that the entire case be remanded.
Let me ask you, I think that the trial court noted that the objection occurred during the charge of the jury in its denial of the motion for new trial, correct?
It was noted in a footnote.
Okay, so
the conversation as we just went through was noted in the footnote in the motion overruling the motion or in the decision overruling the motion for new trial.
Okay, so the trial court's perception in its role there on the ground with everything happening is that there was an objection and that the trial court noted it. Do we have any ability, or did the Second District have any ability to change the sort of the case facts that were there?
Well, I don't think that you have the authority to change the case facts, but I think there's a difference between that and noting an objection for purposes of ruling on a motion for new trial. I mean, at the time, the words were just as I had spoken now, and we don't think that was an appropriate or a clear and unequivocal objection that would preserve a record for
But if we
appeal.
if we characterize it any other way than what the trial court did in its entry, in its judgment on the motion for new trial, aren't we pretty much saying that the trial court abused its discretion in how it characterized it, and basically in not considering it a waived objection?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe so. He is making this decision. He's noting this now, about 9 months after the motion was filed, motion for new trial. And he is accepting it as for purposes of that motion, accepting that that was an objection. But I don't think that that was a statement of fact as to what happened.
Well, you've got your statement of the case and your statement of the facts, and the trial court basically said on moving, on granting a motion for a new trial. Anyways, the trial court is characterizing it that way, and I'm just concerned whether we have the ability to characterize it any other way. And you say that we do based on what's in the transcript.
I think that you do based upon the record, okay. Yes. But at the end of the day, Your Honor, if you were to remand this case, it should be remanded for a new trial to satisfy the issues of negligence, proximate cause, and damages, and not the limited remand that the Court of Appeals remanded it for.
Thank you. You're into Mr. Welsh's rebuttal time. Mr. Atkinson, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name again is Pat Atkinson. I represented the plaintiffs in this case. And let me talk about the waiver issue first, if I can. I asked the court at the time to approach the bench, which you don't do lightly, by the way. I brought the documents with me to the sidebar, brought it to the attention of the trial court judge, and the trial court judge expressly stated, although there are plenty of things missing because of that white noise that we use, specifically stated on the record in the transcript, I will note your objection and overrule it. And he said.
So where in the transcript can I find it?
If you look on the first partial transcript, because the only transcript here is not the testimony of the witnesses, because it was unnecessary to this issue, is the discussions that took place during the course of jury instructions. So when I approached the bench, if you look in the transcript, you'll see a couple of comments back and forth between the judge and I, and then the judge, then a few indecipherables in there, and then the judge says, I note your objection, and I'm going to do it the way it stands. I don't know what else I can say other than, you know, my portion of what was said was in the indecipherable, so I'm stuck with that. But I also have the judge specifically, expressly saying that he's noting my objection. And in his own opinion later, acknowledged that I made an objection. And the Court of Appeals also indicated that I made an objection. So while there was some general commentary later on in terms of supplementing the record, the fact of the matter is, at that sidebar, at which none of the defense attorneys even commented, the judge acknowledged what I was up there for, which was to point out to him that, in my opinion, the jury instruction charges were incorrect. I don't know what else I can do. So let me touch very briefly on the try the whole case all over again thing. Obviously.
Let me ask you about what's
sure.
Kind of bothers me about your argument here. This every juror rule, I guess. So under your theory, you could have two jurors who you could have two jurors who found there was no breach of the standard of care. You could have a different two jurors who found that there was no causation. So you have six to two on each, but different two in the minority saying no breach or no causation. And under your theory, that should be a plaintiff's verdict. Is that right?
Under the law as it stands, that is correct, Your Honor.
Well, but
the any jury.
How is that the law as it stands? I look at Rule 49A, and says a general verdict by which a jury generally finds in favor of the prevailing party shall be used. Now, if you have four of eight who don't find in favor of the prevailing party because they haven't found one or the other elements of the case, how could that be a plaintiff's verdict?
Because any majority rule utilizes a method by which it considers each independent element.
But isn't that inconsistent with the idea of a general verdict by which the jury generally finds in favor of the prevailing party? Will you have half the jury who says that there's been no showing here of liability, that the plaintiff would still get a verdict? That can't be right, can it?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think that's possible.
Well, it is possible, right? Because you would
have, sorry, I'm
because you would have, and under my scenario, you would have six jurors who said that there was a breach, but two who said they didn't. And then you would have six jurors who said there was proximate cause, but a different two jurors who said there was no proximate cause. But under your every juror theory, that would still entitle the plaintiff to a verdict.
Well, if the verdict is signed by six jurors.
What six jurors could sign that general verdict when there's only four of those jurors who find all the elements? What juror could lawfully put their name to that general verdict saying that they have found all the elements?
Well, I'm not sure I understand you, but I'll give it a try.
Well, if you have four jurors for different reasons who have found that there's no liability because either there was no breach or no causation, how could you have six jurors sign that general verdict?
In part because part of the any majority rule is that you are allowed to accept the other juror's decision and move on to the next step. You don't, just because you don't vote along with them, you still are entitled to accept that and consider it as you consider the next issue in line. There's no particular reason why you couldn't accept what.
How could a juror logically accept that if they did not participate in making that? They are the finding of fact. And that juror that you're talking about has made a finding of fact that there is no negligence. They should not move on to the next issue, which is a requirement of even contemplating that issue, is a finding of negligence.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but the issue is if you start with six who say negligent, and you have two that did not sign off on it. Under the law as it's been for many, many years, the two that didn't sign off on it are entitled to accept the decision made by the others and continue to participate in the case.
Even though they have found that an essential element towards reaching the second element has not been established.
It's because it's the jury as a whole, not in piecemeal fashion. In the jury rule approach, it's actually juror inclusion oriented. It is an effort to have all of the jurors participate in all of the independent elements of the case. They're not interdependent, as was said by defense counsel. These are, for many, many years, these have been considered to be independent elements of the case. The O'Connell case that this court issued was about a secondary issue, and that's where the same jury rule came in.
And we're not talking about comparative negligence. We're just talking about simple negligence and the question of proximate cause.
Well, let's say, for example, this case. In this case, the proximate cause argument made by the defense had nothing to do with the issues pertaining to the negligence of the anesthesiology team, or CRNA. There's two totally different things. Bless you. So when the juror initially finds that there are six jurors who say, we find negligence, The defense's argument is we don't necessarily agree with that, but it doesn't matter because we have a completely total, complete separate argument we want to make that says there's no causation.
So the question,
all of the jurors should be entitled to both to rule or decide and participate in the discussion on both of those elements.
So, and you're speaking it from the standpoint of the jury, and there is concern about full participation of the jury. But when we go to the question of the right to a jury trial, it's a substantial right, correct?
Right.
Which is why you've made the request for the relief that you have. So the defense has made the argument that it's just inconceivable that two jurors who didn't sign off on negligence would sign off on proximate cause. But that's, I guess what I'm saying is, if we were to just go along with the OJI rule, would we in some way be affecting that substantial right of a person to have a jury trial full and robust as it's envisioned in a democracy?
Well, what was in the OJI footnote, we would be having a situation where two jurors would be precluded from participating.
And the flip side of that is the defendant or the plaintiff would be, either party would be precluded from having those two jurors fully participate.
Right. So if you flip this case around and say, for hypothetical reasons, that the jury found, six members of the jury found proximate cause, then the defense would be in the same position I'm in. They would be arguing that those two jurors who didn't vote negligence were precluded from participating on the cause issue, and that's depriving us of our constitutional right to a jury. They would have the same argument, the same position as I have now.
So you
need jury participation, and that's what any majority rule is.
You have six jurors who sign for negligence. So hypothetically, the two that said there is no negligence in this case, two vote for proximate cause and two who voted for negligence don't vote for proximate cause. And you think that that is a two-thirds majority of the jury to bring a verdict?
What I would say is,
I want to know, are you telling me that that split, six say negligence and two say there's absolutely no negligence in this case, that then you go on to the issue of proximate cause? Two of those jurors who voted for negligence, a finding, and the two that found no negligence sign off on proximate cause. You're saying that you have a two-thirds majority verdict.
My position would be, if I was the judge, I'd have the jury go back and discuss the matter. But
so
I certainly would not.
You're indicating, though, by saying that that's an invalid verdict. If you as the trial court judge are saying, I'm going to send them back to rediscuss this, then you find the flaw in the verdict form.
I find it to be an incomplete decision, but I certainly would consider that to be a far better approach than precluding jurors from participating.
But here, what we have was six negligence, same six finding no proximate cause. What kind of case do we have?
We don't know what those two jurors were going to do. Nobody could possibly say what those jurors would have done in the 3 hours that the jury was back in the room deliberating. I've tried 125 or more cases as a defense attorney, and this was my first plaintiff's case.
Okay.
You don't know, not you personally, but
right.
You don't know.
But I do know that the same six voted no proximate cause. So,
had to.
No, so no matter how the other two participated, it's kind of irrelevant, isn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe firmly that the jury is entitled to participate in a discussion. The trial court is really obligated to tell the jury, you're all entitled to your opinions, all of you participate, Everybody is entitled to be a part of this, and to say that two of you cannot participate is, in my view, just simply wrong.
There's no guarantee in the, there's no set number of jurors in the Constitution, right?
I think it just says jury,
right,
so, inviolate.
So the legislature could pass a law that says you can only have five jurors in a civil case. That wouldn't violate the Constitution. Why does only having six deliberate violate the Constitution?
Because you had eight.
How do you get that from the text, though?
Excuse me?
How do you get that from the text of the Constitution?
Well, you're talking about switching the number of jurors from five
right,
or six.
There's no guarantee of any specific number of jurors.
And my position would still be the same. If you had five jurors or six jurors and only three of them participated in the discussion, I think that's a problem.
And if you had, I mean, wouldn't the scenario in the OJI rule also put pressure on the people who found negligence to also find proximate cause, if not everyone could participate in that discussion of proximate cause?
Right. It essentially becomes a necessary unanimous decision by the six who are allowed to participate.
Counsel, let me ask you, in the interrogatory on negligence in this case, did it have underlying language that said, if six of the eight of you, if your answer is no, sign the general verdict in favor of the defendant, right? That should have been in there.
Something along those lines, I'm sure.
So that took them to their steps. Obviously, we don't know what happened in their deliberations, but they made an essential, six of them made a finding of fact that there was negligence, right?
Right.
Okay, and it just said, OJI says, only those six of you can participate. Not, the other two don't have to remain silent in the jury room, but the other, they can't make the finding of proximate cause if they didn't reach that. It doesn't make any sense. How does it make sense that one of those jurors could ever find proximate cause if they didn't find negligence? How could they reach that conclusion?
How could they reach a conclusion that there was proximate cause?
Yes. By accepting what they didn't find?
Jurors every day, every week in this state, if they've decided the issue of negligence, the issue of proximate cause is a completely separate thing. The juror can say, look, I don't think it was negligence. I agree that what that doctor did was the cause of all these problems. I just don't happen to think it's negligence. There is nothing wrong with that position to be taken by a juror who's entitled to participate in the discussion.
Right. And how do we know that didn't happen? They could say, "Hey, I didn't buy the negligence." But you know, if you're going to accept that hypothetically, you can't say proximate cause. And
well, what reason why we can't say it didn't happen is because we have to assume that the jury follows the law that the court gives them, and the court's instructions were clear: if you are not one of the six, you cannot participate in the discussion. And the law is very clear that we have to assume that the jury follows the law unless there's some reason to think otherwise, and there isn't in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Welsh, there are 26 seconds.
26 seconds, yes.
Remaining.
First of all, negligence and proximate cause certainly are interdependent. One depends on the other. Negligence is a precondition to proximate cause because the jury has to decide to get to liability that the negligence of the defendant, not set of actions, some other cause, that the defendant's negligence was a proximate cause. The court has illustrated the problems with the any majority rule being a less than three-fourths majority. The same juror rule on negligence and proximate cause ensures consistent, proper, and constitutional verdicts with a concurrence of three-fourths majority.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, will you please recess the court?